This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
Every year, I find it intriguing. There are along coastline states and other countries, along ocean fronts around the world that hold elaborate contests every year in the summer months. Sandcastle building contests. Some tournaments offer cash prizes of $10,000 and more. And some of the winners, I went online and looked from this year's competition around the country, featured incredibly exquisite, beautiful artistry. It's amazing what somebody can do with sand. I used to just pour it out of a pail and stomp on it, but look at what people do. Some of the entries this year were huge in scope and size, palaces really made of sand and water. Every year, thousands of people come to watch these contestants as they create their masterpieces on the shore. What's really remarkable to me is that these can be built in such a short amount of time. Typically, the contest will begin around 9 a.m., and it runs until late afternoon. The contestants choose their place along the beach and start from scratch. But they got to finish their masterpieces around 3 o'clock so their entries can be judged. And that's because somebody else is going to show up to take a close look at these masterpieces, these sandcastles. He never fails to show up right on time. And when he does, everything stops. We call him the tide. The tide is coming in. And when he arrives, all these sandcastles and these creative marvels are washed away. I did a little digging and found that the history of the English word for tide originally referred to a portion of time. In fact, tide and time are close cousins in the English language. We use the word today, the words glad tidings. That means there's going to be a glad season of time. There are going to be glad events. Think of the King James Version's translation recording the angels delivering to the shepherds good tidings of great joy regarding the birth of Jesus, Luke chapter 2, verse 10. It's also interesting to discover that the word tide originally carried the idea that not only was something going to happen, but something was going to happen that was predictable. It was as certain as the rising and falling of the ocean's waters, which is why the word tide got attached to that event. It was always on time, always expected. In fact, there's nothing a sandcastle could ever do to avoid it. No matter how beautiful, how elaborate, where it placed in the contest, how magnificent, the tide was on his way. You know, it occurs to me, it doesn't matter if people spend their time making sandcastle masterpieces or just pouring piles of sand out of a plastic pail. That coming tide cannot be rescheduled. The tide is going to come in. That, by the way, happens to be an issue, in a sense, that's keeping Solomon up at night. And he describes his frustration for us here in his private journal, if you're with us in our last study in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Solomon is asking the question, is there anything I can do? Is there anything I can experience? Is there anything I can accomplish that will make me hang on to happiness? Is there anything that'll make it last long? In fact, throughout life, the answer is no. No matter what accomplishment, no matter what that thrill is, like winning Wimbledon, one tennis professional admitted to a reporter not too long ago, the euphoria she felt, she said, lasted about 2 minutes. Hanging on to happiness, Solomon concludes, is like trying to catch the wind in a net. Now, we arrive at a section in his journal where he's going to ask another question. He's going to ask the question, is there any advantage to living wisely rather than living wildly. So let's pick it up at chapter 2 and verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Now what Solomon does here is he turns his attention to a new train of thinking, a train of thought. So I turned, the Hebrew could be rendered, I turned my attention to think about this. Is there any advantage to living wisely or wildly? And by the way, the combination of the words madness and folly are not two different things. They're combined, and I'll do it in this journal several times, to basically refer to the wildest, craziest party life that you could ever imagine. And notice in this text that Solomon suggests that there isn't any man who's ever going to come after him who can experience it even more wildly than he did. That they could somehow live more prudently than he did. There isn't anybody that's going to be able to experiment with anything more than he has been able to experience. So here's the question. Is living a moderate, prudent, moral, wise life any better than living the party life? Which commercial is it? Early to bed? Early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. Is it that commercial? Or is it you only go around once in life, so grab all the gusto you can while you have the chance? Is that it? Which one? Which direction is going to be better? And I got to tell you that even though most of his journal has been rather negative and jaded, you know, Solomon's answer might surprise you. Notice verse 13. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. And you're thinking, finally, there's a verse I can memorize. I might read that every so often. I'll let my kids read this one. Using your head is smarter than running wild. Way to go, Solomon. Finally. He says there's more gain in wisdom. By the way, the word gain in the Hebrew language is a commercial term which you can translate profit or advantage. He's saying yes. There is an advantage to living wisely rather than living wildly. In fact, you notice in the text he equates folly with darkness and he equates wisdom with light. Now he goes on, as he does here, he drops in this proverb, verse 14. A wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. What does that mean? The wise person has his eyes in his head, meaning he has his eyes open. He's got 20/20 vision. But the fool walks through life as in a fog. We would describe a foolish man today by saying something like, that guy's in the dark. He's in the dark. There's no light bulb turned on in the attic. He's not thinking. One author commented, a German author, that as I was reading that this Hebrew proverb, this Hebraism, is translated into his German culture to read, he who wants to play chess had better not keep his eyes in his pocket. Which is a silly way of saying life is like the game of chess and you better have both eyes open and alert. My grandmother taught me that. She taught me how to play chess. One of the things that she taught me was that if I'm playing her in chess, I'd better stay alert. And I never beat her, by the way, ever. You know, she might have been an older woman. She might have been my grandmother. But when it came to playing chess, she was bloodthirsty, vicious, unmerciful. After years of counseling, I think I'm over it. But at any rate, I never did beat her. But she taught me a good life lesson. Life, like chess, is you better keep your eyes open The fool, on the other hand, notice, is in constant trouble. Now, the word fool, or the term, he's not using this derogative "you fool" kind of thing that you hear out there. The word fool, the term in Ecclesiastes, and he's going to use it 18 times, isn't referring to somebody with a low IQ or the village idiot or whatever. He's referring to a person who lives an evil life, a dishonorable life, a life that rebels against God, a God-dishonoring life. You can think of it this way. The fool does not have his moral headlights turned on. And so he drives in the dark, and he just totals his life, one event after another. You go to the jails and interview them, or the halfway houses, and ask them, what is it like to total your life by keeping those headlights off? This is the idea here. The only thing a foolish person seems to be looking for is the next opportunity to sin. That's what they're alert to. You might work around them. Hey, you wouldn't. I'm not recommending you go in and call them a foolish person. But they can't wait for the weekend. Why? Because they're looking forward. They got their eyes alerted. You can't imagine the sin in front of me. Man, I can't wait. This is the foolish person. And so back to the question, is there an advantage to living wisely or foolishly? And Solomon says, yes, there is an advantage to living wisely. But before you and I, you know, run to Solomon and say, I'm so glad to see you finally writing a verse, you know, I can memorize or use in my devotions. Solomon says, not so fast, not so fast. Next verse. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and yet, not so fast. But I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. The same event, mechre, in the Hebrew language, means fate or destiny. The same thing is going to happen to us all. Verse 15. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so wise? Oh man, here goes Solomon again. And what is that event that will happen to both the wise and the fool? Skip down to verse 16. The wise dies just like the fool. The tide comes in for us all. Solomon says, okay, that eliminates any advantage. You thought I was going to take you down that path, but I'm not going to. Do whatever you want to do. Build an elaborate sandcastle, or just pile sand in a big mound. Or don't even go to the beach, for that matter. Doesn't matter. The tide is coming in for us all. Then he makes a couple of observations that affect us all. And by the way, he's telling the truth here. It's brutal, whether we want to hear it or not. Here's the first. No matter what you do, your accomplishments are forgettable. I know this is encouraging to hear on a Sunday morning, and he came early to hear that, but this is the brutal fact of life. Look at verse 16 again. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have long been forgotten. Now, he's already talked about that in chapter 1, verse 11, if you were with us. He said it this way, generations come, go, and the generations that come after forget the generations that came before. We tend to forget. He's not trying to be mean. He's not trying to rub your nose in it. He's trying to be painfully honest. This is his observation of a very discerning man. Our lives will be forgotten. Solomon already knew, by the way, how the Egyptian pharaohs were living. They had the practice, even during Solomon's life, nearby, of sandblasting off the names of their predecessor pharaohs and chiseling their names into the monuments. They didn't even want their predecessor to be remembered as soon as he, you know, bit the dust. Just forget about them, and they used to do that, and Solomon knew that. In fact, the Egyptian texts written about the same time Solomon lived, which had been excavated, read, and I translate, read from the translation. Those who built pyramids, the pharaohs, are soon forgotten. Those who were once considered gods lie forgotten in their tombs. Here's the brutal truth. One day, nobody on the planet is going to remember you or what you did, no matter how big the monument is which you build. In fact, in my research for these studies, I read recently an article by a genealogist who is studying the area of modern genealogy, and the article commented that the average person doesn't know the names of their family members beyond four generations on average. If you do, you're remarkable. You're an exception to the rule. So you know your parents' names. You know your grandparents' names. How about your great-grandparents' names? How about your great-great-grandparents' names? Now, unless you've been named Fred and it's been carried on, you're Fred the Fifth. You know, that doesn't count. Doesn't count. Just four generations. In fact, the names of people without whom you would not be here today. No matter what you do, your accomplishments are forgettable. Secondly, Solomon essentially adds, no matter who you are, your death is unavoidable. He adds this exclamation point. Go back then to verse 16, how the wise dies just like the fool. And what he means is, we all occupy that tomb, whether you're the brightest person in kindergarten or not so bright. No matter how smart you were, no matter how much you had, no matter how big your sandcastle was, how many garages were attached to it, no matter how much stuff you had stored in the attic, no matter how many toys you had, that bumper sticker was wrong. It reads, "The man with the most toys wins." Solomon would say, it ought to read, "The man with the most toys still dies." Can you handle that truth? Some might with bravado say, "I know it's coming, who cares?" I was behind this past week, a Mustang GT who was going faster than I was, which bothered me a little bit, but I let him go. And as he was taken off, his license plate read, "Hell Bound." And I wondered if he knew. The tide is coming in. And with the shadows of death reflecting back on Solomon's life, he comes to three conclusions. Let me give them to you quickly. First of all, life has become disgusting. Verse 17, just the first phrase, "So I hated life." Not the kind of guy you want to take to lunch. I hated life. You could paraphrase this to read, "Therefore I was disgusted with life." I mean, when I think about the fact, here I am working away, building this masterpiece, here comes the tide. Well, this is disgusting. He's angry. He's frustrated. He's come to the realization that no matter how long he lives, he's going to die just like everybody else. So who cares about the sandcastle? And this is true for those that reflect on death, believer and unbeliever. It is, for the believer, a sign of wisdom that we count the days, we number our days, we consider our mortality. For the unbeliever, without any hope, it would lead to this kind of anger. And again, we got to remember, Ecclesiastes is understood backward. He gets to his grand conclusion in chapter 12. I came across, by the way, an article of a man that reminds me of Solomon, one of the, I think he's the fourth richest man on the planet right now. He's worth about $55 billion. He's pouring money. He's already poured $40 million of it into what he's calling, quote, lifespan development processes. In other words, ways to figure out how to avoid that tide. Nothing wrong with longer lives. Larry Ellison said this, however, in an interview, death makes me angry. It doesn't make any sense to me. Death has never made any sense to me. How can a person be there and then just vanish and not be there? The idea of death makes me disgusted in life. Solomon adds, life has not only become disgusting, life has become distasteful. Verse 17, so I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. Adds that little phrase to a phrase we've already studied. The Hebrew term for grievous can be rendered unpleasant or distasteful. In fact, it's a word attached to bitter herbs. He's saying life down here under the sun is like one meal of bitter herbs after another. None of it tastes good. I mean, think about it. The tide's coming in. Have some ice cream. And how good is that going to taste when the tide's coming in? He's giving us the truth. He adds, thirdly, life has become disheartening. See, under the sun, down here, all is vanity and striving after wind. If there are no pockets in shrouds, as the Jewish proverb says, if as George Strait, the country western singer, used to sing it, if he's never seen a hearse with a luggage rack on top. It's a deep thought, but it's true. Billy Graham kind of coined it this way. You've never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul to the cemetery plot, right? Then yes, if that's what you're living for, then no matter how much you stuff in your pockets, all you've done is chase after the wind, and in the end you've caught nothing. For the believer, life can be at times distasteful and disgusting and disheartening. Solomon is telling us the truth, but Solomon isn't telling us the whole truth. Remember, he's stuck down here at this point in his journal with the perspective that never goes any higher than the sun. But if you go to the end of his journal, and I keep taking us there to make sense of what he's writing here, but it's going to be that grand observation. Remember your Creator. Don't forget your Creator. If you don't belong by faith to your Creator who reigns above the sun, then you're stuck down here. And then all you really are doing is temporarily building a sandcastle without any hope beyond the grave. My friend, you can't avoid the tide. You can't cheat the tide. You can't reschedule the tide. But by faith in Jesus Christ, you can rise above the tide one day. For Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, even though he dies, yet shall he live. John 11:25. How? Well, for God so loved the world of humanity stuck down here under the sun, that he sent his son to come here under the sun and live among us and live a perfect life and die for us so that if we believe in him, we will not perish, that is eternal judgment, but have everlasting life. So do you know him? If you don't, build the best sandcastle you can. But in the end, the tide will come. Perhaps God has brought you here to this moment in your life to hear this truth. There's more to life than that. In his private journal, another preacher wrote this. His name was John Wesley, and he entered this in his journal on January 2nd, 1777, as a 66-year-old man. And with this I close. I have begun expounding on the book of Ecclesiastes. By the way, I wish I had his notes. Wish I knew how long it would take, so I could tell you, to encourage you. He said, I never before had so clear a sight of the meaning of it. Neither did I imagine that its parts were so connected together, all ending up to prove that grand truth, that there is no lasting happiness outside of God. Father, thank you for your word and the truth of it. Maybe a little uncomfortable to consider our mortality, and yet it is part of a wise life. You've told us in your word. To consider the path of our feet, the direction in which our toes are pointed, our relationship with you, our Creator God, our submission and surrender to you, our Redeemer, Lord. Thank you for giving us the privilege and abilities and creative skills to build these sandcastles. Whatever it is in life you've called us to do. Thank you for that. And as we'll learn, there is joy in this gift from you. But thank you. Thank you, Father, that we can rehearse the truth that for all of us, even though the tide is coming, there's a way up and out and to you forever.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.